So now we go on with the second paper from Meltem Ahiska from Bosphorus University. She has a paper on strangers to the West, ordinary Orientalism and Occidentalisms.
Thank you. I would like to share with you some thoughts that are generated by reflecting on my previous work on Occidentalism and revisiting the civilizational discourse in connection to racialization. Furthermore, I would like to dwell on the contemporary figure of the immigrant as stranger vis-à-vis the so-called Western civilization. I developed the frame of Occidentalism in dialogue with several theories that come from the studies of Orientalism, postcoloniality, critical theory, and gender. The challenge for me was to understand a particular hegemonic type of subjectivity that was informed by a particular response to Orientalism in a country that has aspired to be, and still does, to be the bridge between the Orient and the Occident. I argued that every attempt to define, to build, to demarcate modern national Turkish identity was shaped with reference to an imagined Westernness and for the Western gaze. Of course, the West had shifting meanings both inside and outside. While in different contexts, it could be Europe or the US as the West, it was also associated with certain groups and regions in the society, in the Turkish society, and thus utilized to give a meaning to a set of binaries most prominently formulated as culture versus civilization. In other words, I tried, rather than looking for universal tendencies or deficiencies in Turkish history, as Western developmental discourses would posit, I attempted to see how a certain subjectivity and the accompanying truth claims have been dialogically produced and historically sustained within a complex material and discursive interdependence between Turkey and the so-called West, and which allowed a certain national regime of power in Turkey. Civilization has always been the code word, a persisting norm in this complex process of boundary management and negotiation between East and West. As Şerif Mardin argued, the nationalist elites in Turkey, in founding the new Turkey, had to work for something which did not exist as if it existed and make it exist. According to Mardin, nation and Western civilization were two fundamental code words for this. However, the appropriation of the civilizational norm in such a regime of power entails paradoxes. It is interesting that modern Turkish history always refers back to Western civilization as part of its development. It is something alien, yet at the same time the source of its origin, which the subject desires simultaneously to bring closer, to internalize it, and to destroy it as foreign at the same time. Primarily, this is the paradoxical, yet enabling in terms of power, subjective dynamic of Occidentalism in my view. The situation is not unique to Turkey, of course. The non-West has been labeled as backward, meaning not only belated, but also non-civilized, and located at the lower stages of universalized Western modernity, exposed to a profound crisis in terms of its own history. Chakrabarty, in his criticism of Western historicism, refers to this phenomenon as the waiting room of history for the non-Westerners. It is no coincidence that a Turkish historian titled his book as The Waiting Room of Civilization much before Chakrabarty used this phrase. Interestingly, the author of this book, Tarık Zafer Tunay'a, is quoting the phrase from even a much earlier source, from İzzet Fuat Paşa, an Ottoman statesman. İzzet Fuat Paşa's words, also published in French in 1913, are striking. A quote, "Those nations which dream are unhappy. Despite our institutions, schools, and citizens living in the West, we very much remained as Asian dreamers. We're not only physically but also mentally lazy, since we have not really ventured to learn why we are left so far from this good and beautiful civilization. Until we are reformed, we are going to stay in the waiting room of civilization. End of quote. The waiting room of history or civilization denotes yearning, recognition from an imagined authority. But it also confides a story of self-depreciation projected from the imagined Western gaze, which has deemed local experience as such unworthy of knowledge and registered. Yet I argue that the internalized feeling of unworthiness leads to a serious aggressive reactions against the foreign aspects of Westernness, both inside and outside. One can cite many recurring themes and incidents in Turkish history within which the splitting of the subject can be observed. This split is also manifested in official discourse. I would like to give just two classical, in quotation marks, examples. One comes from Mustafa Kemal's own description of civilization. He said, civilization is such a fire that it burns and destroys those who ignore it. It is futile to resist the thunderous advance of civilization, for it has no pity on those who are ignorant or rebellious. We can see here that the civilizational discourse is transferred to a non-Western context with images of force and violence, while at the same time it is heralded as a desirable target. The other example can come from the lyrics of the Turkish national anthem, which reads, "Fear not, how can that monster called civilization choke with the last tooth in its jaw the faith of an entire nation?" The relation with civilization has always been an ambivalent one and continues to be so. The Prime Minister Tayyip Erdogan's address to the youth in 2008 is illuminating in this respect. Erdogan, interestingly, evoked the conceptual frame of culture versus civilization in his public speech. He said, "Unfortunately, we have taken the immorality of the West, which goes against our values, instead of taking its science and knowledge." Erdogan particularly cited the words of Mehmet Akif Ersoy, the poet who wrote the lyrics of the Turkish national anthem, in order to emphasize the division between the desired Western arts, science, and knowledge and the undesired Western immorality. So Erdogan's speech is significant not because it demonstrates an ideological continuum in Turkish nationalism. On the contrary, the rupture in the Republican ideology that Erdogan and his party represent in terms of utilizing Islam as a political force that has been repressed before makes his words more striking. Despite the cracks in the once unifying ideology of Kemalism and nationalism in today's Turkey, the formula of Occidentalism still retains its centrality for establishing hegemony. There is an appeal to the consent of the majority on the very basis of the need to synthesize Orient and the Occident. And within this oscillating desire of hatred and desire and hatred, the norm of the West as civilization is being constantly reproduced. The simultaneity of, on the one side, aggression towards the West, and on the other, to desire to become Western and to be accepted as Western, has produced a complex regime of power and truth. So since I have 5 minutes, I'll skip some parts of it. I would claim that with 19th and 20th century divisions of East and West have changed, of course, today, and has given way to more complex configurations. There are new economic powers, new entities, new divisions and polarities, new metaphors to define the globe. And we can argue with Gilles Eyal that the Orient has been disenchanted to a great extent. So there is this ordinariness of the civilizational norm that lies at the core of the distinction between the East and West that informs contemporary Orientalisms and Occidentalism. And I would say it's not independent of the forms of new racism, which is hidden under other cloaks. So as Gilroy argues, we increasingly face a racism which avoids being recognized as such, and because it's able to link race with other things, with nationhood, with patriotism and nationalism. So I don't know how to continue because, okay, I'm a bit, as long as the civilizational norm posits an irreducible difference between the civilized self and the potentially threatening other, it feeds and reproduces racism. If in the West, forms of racism are disguised under, for example, teaching tolerance to others, it is fostered in the non-West by a resentful and aggressive denial of its own victimization by the norm, only to produce a racialized other of the other. I would like to, I don't want to skip this, give an example of how this dynamic works. The memoirs of the Turkish students sent to Europe by the state, Turkish state, at the end of the 1930s are striking to reveal how this works. A letter written from Berlin in 1938 of an architecture student to his family. He says, "We have always heard good things about Turks here, but the only thing that is bothersome is that when walking in the street or sitting somewhere, they keep looking at us strangely because we are dark-colored. But you should not think that all people here have enmity against Jews, as some would say. But there is only a group of young people constantly attacking Jews. The other day we saw them beating a Jewish man and burning two great synagogues. Yet nobody harassed us thinking that we are Jews. But the other night, when they were demonstrating against the Jews, a group of Turkish men who met in the club after hearing the news of Atatürk's death had some problems when they were going out of the club. They say that the Germans, seeing a group of dark-colored men, thought these to be a movement equivalent to Jews and made lots of noise, and finally the police solved the problem. After all these, it was pronounced by General Göring that Jews should not be bothered. Now it seems that everything is under control and peaceful. Oh, Germany is such a country. Imagine a country where all roads are asphalt-coated, all pavements are concrete, and two-thirds of the roads are allotted to pedestrians, and the middle lane is left for cars." This is the end of quote. The euphemistic phrases in this letter, characterized by indifference and lack of awareness of the coming genocide in Germany, cannot be explained by anything other than the strong desire for the civilizational norm, which is only possible to uphold if you deny the conditions of your own victimization and racialization. In this narrative, the line that differentiates the Jew and the Turk seems to be very thin. So maybe I also think that the figure of the immigrant as a stranger, as in Balibar's terms, is the name of the race, of the new racism. So just a concluding sentence. I would say that looking at the prospects of changing relations of Turkey with Europe and its changes of acceptance into the European Union, I think we need to go beyond international relations or interstate relations by also taking account of the conditions of the non-Western immigrants in Europe, because conditions and experiences of both legal and illegal immigration reveal more clearly what is at stake in the civilizational clash, which I think itself a misnomer for racism. Thank you very much.